judicious advice, to give up his dissipated life, his unseemly love affair, the waste of his youth and vigour in pot-house debauchery, and to set off to Siberia to the gold mines. That would be an outlet for your turbulent energies, your romantic character, your thirst for adventure."
After describing the result of this conversation and the moment when the prisoner learned that Grushenka had not remained at Samsonov's, the sudden frenzy of the luckless man, worn out with jealousy and nervous exhaustion at the thought that she had deceived him and was now with his father, Ippolit Kirillovich concluded by dwelling upon the fatal influence of chance.
Had the maid told him that her mistress was at Mokroe with her former lover, nothing would have happened. But she lost her head, she could only swear and protest her ignorance, and if the prisoner did not kill her on the spot, it was only because he flew in pursuit of his false mistress. But note, frantic as he was, he took with him a brass pestle. Why that? Why not some other weapon? But since he had been contemplating his plan and preparing himself for it for a whole month, he would snatch up anything like a weapon that caught his eye. He had realized for a month past that any object of the kind would serve as a weapon, so he instantly, without hesitation, recognized that it would serve his purpose. So it was by no means unconsciously, by no means involuntarily, that he snatched up that fatal pestle. And then we find him in his father's garden. The coast is clear, there are no witnesses, darkness and jealousy. The suspicion that she was there with him, with his rival, in his arms and perhaps laughing at him at that moment, took his breath away. And it was not mere suspicion, the deception was open, obvious. She must be there in that lighted room, she must be behind the screen. And the unhappy man would have us believe that he stole up to the window, peeped respectfully in and discreetly withdrew, for fear something terrible and immoral should happen. And he tries to persuade us of that. Us, who understand his character, who know his state of mind at the moment, and that he knew the signals by which he could at once enter the house.
At this point Ippolit Kirillovich broke off to discuss exhaustively the suspected connection of Smerdyakov with the murder. He did this very circumstantially, and everyone realized that, although he professed to despise that suspicion, he thought the subject of great importance. Chapter 8. A Treatise on Smerdyakov.
"To begin with, what was the source of this suspicion?" Ippolit Kirillovich began. "The first person who cried out that Smerdyakov had committed the murder was the prisoner himself at the moment of his arrest. Yet from that time to this, he had not brought forward a single fact to confirm the charge, nor the faintest suggestion of a fact. The charge is confirmed by three persons only, the two brothers of the prisoner, and Madame Svietlov. The elder of these brothers expressed his suspicions only today, when he was undoubtedly suffering from brain fever. But we know that for the last 2 months he has completely shared our conviction of his brother's guilt and did not attempt to combat that idea. But of that later. The younger brother has admitted that he has not the slightest fact to support his notion of Smerdyakov's guilt and has only been led to that conclusion from the prisoner's own words and the expression of his face. Yes, that astounding piece of evidence has been brought forward twice today by him. Madame Svietlov is even more astounding. What the prisoner tells you, you must believe. He's not a man to tell a lie. That is all the evidence against Smerdyakov produced by these three persons, who are all deeply concerned in the prisoner's fate. And yet the theory of Smerdyakov's guilt has been noised about, has been and is still maintained. Is it creditable? Is it conceivable?"
Here Ippolit Kirillovich thought it necessary to describe the personality of Smerdyakov,
who had cut short his life in a fit of insanity.
He depicted him as a man of weak intellect, with a smattering of education, who had been thrown off his balance by philosophical ideas above his level, and certain modern theories of duty, which he learnt in practice from the reckless life of his master, who was also perhaps his father, Fyodor Pavlovich, and theoretically from various strange philosophical conversations with his master's elder son, Ivan Fyodorovich, who readily indulged in this diversion, probably feeling dull or wishing to amuse himself at the valet's expense.
He spoke to me himself of his spiritual condition during the last few days at his father's house,
Ippolit Kirillovich explained.
But others, too, have borne witness to it, the prisoner himself, his brother, and the servant Grigory. That is all who knew him well. Moreover, Smerdyakov, whose health was shaken by his attacks of epilepsy, had not the courage of a chicken. He fell at my feet and kissed them. The prisoner himself has told us before he realized how damaging such a statement was to himself. He is an epileptic chicken, he declared about him in his characteristic language. And the prisoner chose him for his confidant. We have his own word for it. And he frightened him into consenting at last to act as a spy for him. In that capacity he deceived his master, revealing to the prisoner the existence of the envelope with the notes in it, and the signals by means of which he could get into the house. How could he help telling him, indeed? He would have killed me, I could see that he would have killed me, he said at the inquiry, trembling and shaking even before us, though his tormentor was by that time arrested and could do him no harm. He suspected me at every instant. In fear and trembling, I hastened to tell him every secret to pacify him, that he might see that I had not deceived him and let me off alive. These are his own words. I wrote them down, and I remember them. When he began shouting at me, I would fall on my knees. He was naturally very honest and enjoyed the complete confidence of his master ever since he had restored him some money he had lost. So it may be supposed that the poor fellow suffered pangs of remorse at having deceived his master, whom he loved as his benefactor. Persons severely afflicted with epilepsy are, so the most skilful doctors tell us, always prone to continual and morbid self-reproach. They worry over their wickedness. They are tormented by pangs of conscience, often entirely without cause. They exaggerate and often invent all sorts of faults and crimes. And here we have a man of that type who had rarely been driven to wrongdoing by terror and intimidation. He had, besides, a strong presentiment that something terrible would be the outcome of the situation that was developing before his eyes. When Ivan Fyodorovich was leaving for Moscow just before the catastrophe, Smerdyakov besought him to remain, though he was too timid to tell him plainly what he feared. He confined himself to hints, but his hints were not understood. It must be observed that he looked on Ivan Fyodorovich as a protector, whose presence in the house was a guarantee that no harm would come to pass. Remember the phrase in Dmitri Karamazov's drunken letter? I shall kill the old man if only Ivan goes away. So Ivan Fyodorovich's presence seemed to everyone a guarantee of peace and order in the house. But he went away, and within an hour of his young master's departure, Smerdyakov was taken with an epileptic fit. But that's perfectly intelligible. Here I must mention that Smerdyakov, oppressed by terror and despair of a sort, had felt during those last few days that one of the fits from which he had suffered before at moments of strain might be coming upon him again. The day and hour of such an attack cannot, of course, be foreseen, but every epileptic can feel beforehand that he is likely to have one. So the doctors tell us. And so, as soon as Ivan Fyodorovich had driven out of the yard, Smerdyakov, depressed by his lonely and unprotected position, went to the cellar. He went down the stairs wondering if he would have a fit or not, and what if it were to come upon him at once. And that very apprehension, that very wonder, brought on the spasm in his throat that always precedes such attacks, and he fell unconscious into the cellar. And in this perfectly natural occurrence, people try to detect a suspicion, a hint that he was shamming an attack on purpose. But if it were on purpose, the question arises at once. What was his motive? What was he reckoning on? What was he aiming at? I say nothing about medicine. Science, I'm told, may go astray. The doctors were not able to discriminate between the counterfeit and the real. That may be so, but answer me one question. What motive had he for such a counterfeit? Could he, had he been plotting the murder, have desired to attract the attention of the household by having a fit just before? You see, gentlemen of the jury, on the night of the murder there were five persons in Fyodor Pavlovich's, Fyodor Pavlovich himself, but he did not kill himself, that's evident. Then his servant Grigory, but he was almost killed himself. The third person was Grigory's wife, Marfa Ignatievna, but it would be simply shameful to imagine her murdering her master. Two persons are left, the prisoner and Smerdyakov. But If we are to believe the prisoner's statement that he is not the murderer, then Smerdyakov must have been, for there is no other alternative, no one else can be found. That is what accounts for the artful, astounding accusation against the unhappy idiot who committed suicide yesterday. Had a shadow of suspicion rested on anyone else, had there been any sixth person, I am persuaded that even the prisoner would have been ashamed to accuse Smerdyakov and would have accused that sixth person. For to charge Smerdyakov with that murder is perfectly absurd. Gentlemen, let us lay aside psychology, let us lay aside medicine, let us even lay aside logic, let us turn only to the facts and see what the facts tell us. If Smerdyakov killed him, how did he do it? Alone or with the assistance of the prisoner? Let us consider the first alternative, that he did it alone. If he had killed him, it must have been with some object, for some advantage to himself. But not having a shadow of the motive that the prisoner had for the murder, hatred, jealousy, and so on, Smerdyakov could only have murdered him for the sake of gain, in order to appropriate the 3,000 rubles he had seen his master put in the envelope. And yet, he tells another person, and a person most closely interested, that is, the prisoner, everything about the money and the signals, where the envelope lay, what was written on it, what it was tied up with, and above all, told him of those signals by which he could enter the house. Did he do this simply to betray himself, or to invite to the same enterprise one who would be anxious to get the envelope for himself? Yes, I shall be told, but he betrayed it from fear. But how do you explain this? A man who could conceive such an audacious, savage act and carry it out tells facts which are known to no one else in the world, and which, if he held his tongue, no one would ever have guessed. No, however cowardly he might be, if he had plotted such a crime, nothing would have induced him to tell anyone about the envelope and the signals, for that was as good as betraying himself beforehand. He would have invented something, he would have told some lie if he'd been forced to give information, but he would have been silent about that. For, on the other hand, if he had said nothing about the money but had committed the murder and stolen the money, no one in the world could have charged him with murder for the sake of robbery, since no one but he had seen the money, no one but he knew of its existence in the house. Even if he'd been accused of the murder, it could only have been thought that he committed it from some other motive. But since no one had observed any such motive in him beforehand, and everyone saw, on the contrary, that his master was fond of him and honoured him with his confidence, he would, of course, have been the last to be suspected. People would have suspected first the man who had a motive, a man who had himself declared he had such motives, who had made no secret of it. They would, in fact, have suspected the son of the murdered man, Dmitri Fyodorovitch. Had Smerdyakov killed and robbed him, and the son had been accused of it, that would, of course, have suited Smerdyakov. Yet are we to believe that, though plotting the murder, he told that son, Dmitri, about the money, the envelope, and the signals? Is that logical? Is that clear? When the day of the murder planned by Smerdyakov came, we have him falling downstairs in a feigned fit. With what object? In the first place, that Grigory, who had been intending to take his medicine, might put it off and remain on guard, seeing there was no one to look after the house. And in the second place, I suppose, that his master, seeing that there was no one to guard him, and in terror of a visit from his son, might redouble his vigilance and precaution. And, most of all, I suppose, that he, Smerdyakov, disabled by the fit, might be carried from the kitchen, where he always slept, apart from all the rest, and where he could go in and out as he liked, to Grigory's room at the other end of the lodge, where he was always put, shut off by a screen 3 paces from their own bed. This was the immemorial custom established by his master and the kind-hearted Marfa Ignatyevna, whenever he had a fit. There, lying behind the screen, he would most likely, to keep up the sham, have begun groaning, and so keeping them awake all night, as Grigory and his wife testified. And all this we are to believe that he might more conveniently get up and murder his master. But I shall be told that he shammed illness on purpose that he might not be suspected, and that he told the prisoner of the money and the signals,
to tempt him to commit the murder, and when he had murdered him and had gone away with the money, making a noise, most likely, and waking people. Smerdyakov got up, am I to believe, and went in. What for? To murder his master a second time and carry off the money that had already been stolen? Gentlemen, are you laughing? I'm ashamed to put forward such suggestions, but incredible as it seems, that's just what the prisoner alleges. When he had left the house, had knocked Grigory down and raised an alarm, he tells us Smerdyakov got up, went in, and murdered his master and stole the money. I won't press the point that Smerdyakov could hardly have reckoned on this beforehand, and have foreseen that the furious and exasperated son would simply come to peep in respectfully, though he knew the signals, and beat a retreat, leaving Smerdyakov his booty. Gentlemen of the jury, I put this question to you in earnest. When was the moment when Smerdyakov could have committed his crime? Name that moment, or you can't accuse him. But perhaps the fit was a real one. The sick man suddenly recovered, heard a shout, and went out. Well, what then? He looked about him and said, why not go and kill the master? And how did he know what had happened, since he'd been lying unconscious till that moment? But there's a limit to these flights of fancy. Quite so, some astute people will tell me. But what if they were in agreement? What if they murdered him together and shared the money? What then? A weighty question, truly. And the facts to confirm it are astounding. One commits the murder and takes all the trouble, while his accomplice lies on one side shamming a fit, apparently to arouse suspicion in everyone. Alarm in his master and alarm in Grigory. It would be interesting to know what motives could have induced the two accomplices to form such an insane plan. But perhaps it was not a case of active complicity on Smerdyakov's part, but only of passive acquiescence. Perhaps Smerdyakov was intimidated and agreed not to prevent the murder, and foreseeing that he would be blamed for letting his master be murdered, without screaming for help or resisting, he may have obtained permission from Dmitri Karamazov to get out of the way by shamming a fit. You may murder him as you like, it's nothing to me. But as this attack of Smerdyakov's was bound to throw the household into confusion, Dmitri Karamazov could never have agreed to such a plan. I will waive that point, however. Supposing that he did agree, it would still follow that Dmitri Karamazov is the murderer and the instigator, and Smerdyakov is only a passive accomplice, and not even an accomplice, but merely acquiesced against his will through terror. But what do we see? As soon as he's arrested, the prisoner instantly throws all the blame on Smerdyakov, not accusing him of being his accomplice, but of being himself the murderer. He did it alone, he says. He murdered and robbed him. It was the work of his hands. Strange sort of accomplices who begin to accuse one another at once. And think of the risk for Karamazov. After committing the murder while his accomplice lay in bed, he throws the blame on the invalid, who might well have resented it, and in self-preservation might well have confessed the truth. For he might well have seen that the court would at once charge how far he was responsible, and so he might well have reckoned that if he were punished, it would be far less severely than the real murderer. But in that case he would have been certain to make a confession, yet he's not done so. Smerdyakov never hinted at their complicity, though the actual murderer persisted in accusing him and declaring that he had committed the crime alone. What's more, Smerdyakov at the inquiry volunteered the statement that it was he who had told the prisoner of the envelope of notes and of the signals, and that, but for him, he would have known nothing about them. If he had really been a guilty accomplice, would he so readily have made this statement at the inquiry? On the contrary, he would have tried to conceal it, to distort the facts or minimize them. But he was far from distorting or minimizing them. No one but an innocent man, who had no fear of being charged with complicity, could have acted as he did. And in a fit of melancholy, arising from his disease and this catastrophe, he hanged himself yesterday. He left a note written in his peculiar language. I destroy myself of my own will and inclination so as to throw no blame on anyone. What would it have cost him to add, I am the murderer, not Karamazov, but that he did not add.
Did his conscience lead him to suicide and not to avowing his guilt? And what followed? Notes for 3,000 rubles were brought into the court just now, and we are glad that they were the same that lay in the envelope now on the table before us, and that the witness had received them from Smerdyakov the day before. But I need not recall the painful scene, though I will make one or two comments, selecting such trivial ones as might not be obvious at first sight to everyone, and so may be overlooked. In the first place, Smerdyakov must have given back the money and hanged himself yesterday from remorse. And only yesterday he confessed his guilt to Ivan Karamazov, as the latter informs us. If it were not so, indeed, why should Ivan Fyodorovich have kept silence till now? And so if he has confessed, then why, I ask again, did he not avow the whole truth in the last letter he left behind, knowing that the innocent prisoner had to face this terrible ordeal the next day? The money alone is no proof. A week ago, quite by chance, the fact came to the knowledge of myself and two other persons in this court that Ivan Fyodorovich had sent 2 5% coupons of 5,000 each, that is 10,000 in all, to the chief town of the province to be changed. I only mention this to point out that anyone may have money, and that it can't be proved that these notes are the same as were in Fyodor Pavlovich's envelope. Ivan Karamazov, after receiving yesterday a communication of such importance from the real murderer, did not stir. Why didn't he report it at once? Why did he put it all off till morning? I think I have a right to conjecture why. His health had been giving way for a week past. He had admitted to a doctor and to his most intimate friends that he was suffering from hallucinations and seeing phantoms of the dead. He was on the eve of the attack of brain fever by which he has been stricken down today. In this condition, he suddenly heard of Smerdyakov's death and at once reflected, "The man is dead. I can throw the blame on him and save my brother. I have money. I will take a roll of notes and say that Smerdyakov gave them to me before his death." You will say that was dishonorable. It's dishonorable to slander even the dead, and even to save a brother. True, but what if he slandered him unconsciously? What if, finally unhinged by the sudden news of the valet's death, he imagined it really was so? You saw the recent scene. You have seen the witness's condition. He was standing up and was speaking, but where was his mind? Then followed the document, the prisoner's letter, written 2 days before the crime, and containing a complete program of the murder. Why, then, are we looking for any other program? The crime was committed precisely according to this program, and by no other than the writer of it. Yes, gentlemen of the jury, it went off without a hitch. He did not run respectfully and timidly away from his father's window, though he was firmly convinced that the object of his affections was with him. No, that is absurd and unlikely. He went in and murdered him. Most likely he killed him in anger, burning with resentment as soon as he looked on his hated rival. But having killed him probably with one blow of the brass pestle, and having convinced himself after careful search that she was not there, he did not, however, forget to put his hand under the pillow and take out the envelope, the torn cover of which lies now on the table before us. I mention this fact that you may note one, to my thinking, very characteristic circumstance. Had he been an experienced murderer, and had he committed the murder for the sake of gain only, would he have left the torn envelope on the floor as it was found, beside the corpse? Had it been Smerdyakov, for instance, murdering his master to rob him, he would have simply carried away the envelope with him without troubling himself to open it over his victim's corpse, for he would have known for certain that the notes were in the envelope. They'd been put in and sealed up in his presence, and had he taken the envelope with him, no one would ever have known of the robbery. I ask you, gentlemen, would Smerdyakov have behaved in that way? Would he have left the envelope on the floor? No. This was the action of a frantic murderer, a murderer who was not a thief and had never stolen before that day, who snatched the notes from under the pillow, not like a thief stealing them, but as though seizing his own property from the thief who had stolen it. For that was the idea which had become almost an insane obsession in Dmitri Karamazov in regard to that money, and pouncing upon the envelope, which he'd never seen before, he tore it open to make sure whether the money was in it, and ran away with the money in his pocket, even forgetting to consider that he'd left an astounding piece of evidence against himself in that torn envelope on the floor. All because it was Karamazov, not Smerdyakov. He didn't think, he didn't reflect. And how should he? He ran away. He heard behind him the servant cry out. The old man caught him, stepped him, and was felled to the ground by the brass pestle. The prisoner, moved by pity, leapt down to look at him. Would you believe it? He tells us that he leapt down out of pity, out of compassion, to see whether he could do anything for him. Was that a moment to show compassion? No. He jumped down simply to make certain whether the only witness of his crime were dead or alive. Any other feeling, any other motive would be unnatural. Note that he took trouble over Grigory, wiped his head with his handkerchief, and convincing himself he was dead, he ran to the house of his mistress, dazed and covered with blood. How was it he never thought that he was covered with blood and would be at once detected? But the prisoner himself assures us that he did not even notice that he was covered with blood. That may be believed, that is very possible, that it always happens at such moments with criminals. On one point they will show diabolical cunning, while another will escape them altogether. But he was thinking at that moment of one thing only. Where was she? He wanted to find out at once where she was, so he ran to her lodging and learnt an unexpected, astounding piece of news. She had gone off to Mokroe to meet her first lover.
Chapter 9. The Galloping Troika. The End of the Prosecutor's Speech. Ippolit Kirillovich had chosen the historical method of exposition beloved by all nervous orators, who find in its limitations a check on their own eager rhetoric. At this moment in his speech he went off into a dissertation on Grushenka's first lover, and brought forward several interesting thoughts on this theme.
Karamazov, who had been frantically jealous of everyone, collapsed, so to speak, and effaced himself at once before this first lover. What makes it all the more strange is that he seems to have hardly thought of this formidable rival. But he had looked upon him as a remote danger, and Karamazov always lives in the present. Possibly he regarded him as a fiction. But his wounded heart grasped instantly that the woman had been concealing this new rival and deceiving him because he was anything but a fiction to her, because he was the one hope of her life. Grasping this instantly, he resigned himself. Gentlemen of the jury, I cannot help dwelling on this unexpected trait in the prisoner's character. He suddenly evinces an irresistible desire for justice, a respect for woman, and a recognition of her right to love. And all this at the very moment when he had stained his hands with his father's blood for her sake. It is true that the blood he had shed was already crying out for vengeance, for after having ruined his soul and his life in this world, he was forced to ask himself at that same instant what he was and what he could now be to her. To that being, dearer to him than his own soul, in comparison with that former lover who had returned penitent, with new love to the woman he had once betrayed, with honourable offers, with the promise of a reformed and happy life. And he, luckless man, what could he give her now? What could he offer her? Karamazov felt all this, knew that all ways were barred to him by his crime, and that he was a criminal under sentence, and not a man with life before him. This thought crushed him, and so he instantly flew to one frantic plan, which to a man of Karamazov's character must have appeared the one inevitable way out of his terrible position. That way out was suicide. He ran for the pistols he had left in pledge with his friend Perhotin, and on the way as he ran he pulled out of his pocket the money for the sake of which he'd stained his hands with his father's gore. Oh, now he needed money more than ever. Karamazov would die. Karamazov would shoot himself, and it should be remembered. To be sure, he was a poet and had burnt the candle at both ends all his life. To her, and there, oh there, I will give a feast to the whole world. Such as never was before, that will be remembered and talked of long after. In the midst of shouts of wild merriment, reckless gypsy songs and dances, I shall raise the glass and drink to the woman I adore and her newfound happiness. And then on the spot, at her feet, I shall dash out my brains before her and punish myself. She will remember Mitya Karamazov sometimes. She will see how Mitya loved her. She will feel for Mitya. Here we see in excess a love of effect, a romantic despair and sentimentality, and the wild recklessness of the Karamazovs. Yes, but there is something else, gentlemen of the jury, something that cries out in the soul, throbs incessantly in the mind, and poisons the heart unto death. That something is conscience, gentlemen of the jury, its judgment, its terrible torments. The pistol will settle everything. The pistol is the only way out. But beyond, I don't know whether Karamazov wondered at that moment what lies beyond, and whether Karamazov could, like Hamlet, wonder what lies beyond. No, gentlemen of the jury, they have their Hamlets, but we still have our Karamazovs.
Here Ippolit Kirillovich drew a minute picture of Mitya's preparations, the scene at Perotin's, at the shop, with the drivers. He quoted numerous words and actions confirmed by witnesses, and the picture made a terrible impression on the audience. The guilt of this harassed and desperate man stood out clear and convincing when the facts were brought together.
What need had he of precaution? Two or three times he almost confessed, hinted at it, all but spoke out.
Then followed the evidence given by witnesses.
He even cried out to the peasant who drove him, "Do you know you are driving a murderer?" But it was impossible for him to speak out. He had to get to Mokroe and there to finish his romance. But what was awaiting the luckless man almost from the first moment at Mokroe, he saw that his invincible rival was perhaps by no means so invincible, that the toast to their newfound happiness was not desired and would not be acceptable. But you know the facts, gentlemen of the jury, from the preliminary inquiry. Karamazov's triumph over his rival was complete, and his soul passed into quite a new phase, perhaps the most terrible phase through which his soul has passed or will pass. One may say with certainty, gentlemen of the jury, the prosecutor continued, that outraged nature and the criminal heart bring their own vengeance more completely than any earthly justice. What's more, justice and punishment on earth positively alleviate the punishment of nature, and are indeed essential to the soul of the criminal at such moments, as its salvation from despair. For I cannot imagine the horror and moral suffering of Karamazov when he learnt that she loved him, that for his sake she had rejected her first lover, that she was summoning him, Mitya, to a new life, that she was promising him happiness. And when everything was over for him and nothing was possible... By the way, I will note in parenthesis a point of importance for the light it throws on the prisoner's position at the moment. This woman, this love of his, had been, till the last moment, till the very instant of his arrest, a being unattainable, passionately desired by him, but unattainable. Yet why did he not shoot himself then? Why did he relinquish his design and even forget where his pistol was? It was just that passionate desire for love and the hope of satisfying it that restrained him. Throughout their revels he kept close to his adored mistress, who was at the banquet with him and was more charming and fascinating to him than ever. He did not leave her side, abasing himself in his homage before her. His passion might well for a moment stifle not only the fear of arrest but even the torments of conscience. For a moment, oh, only for a moment... I can picture the state of mind of the criminal hopelessly enslaved by these influences. First, the influence of drink, of noise and excitement, of the thud of the dance and the scream of the song, and of her, flushed with wine, singing and dancing and laughing to him. Secondly, the hope in the background that the fatal end might still be far off, that not till next morning at least they would come and take him. So he had a few hours, and that's much, very much. In a few hours one can think of many things. I imagine that he felt something like what criminals feel when they are being taken to the scaffold. They have another long, long street to pass down, and at walking pace past thousands of people. Then there will be a turning into another street, and only at the end of that street the dread place of execution. I fancy that at the beginning of the journey the condemned man sitting on his shameful cart must feel that he has infinite life still before him. The houses recede, the cart moves on. Oh, that's nothing, it's still far to the turning into the second street, and he still looks boldly to right and to left at those thousands of callously curious people with their eyes fixed on him, and he still fancies that he is just such a man as they. But now the turning comes to the next street. Oh, that's nothing, nothing. There's still a whole street before him, and however many houses have been passed, he will still think there are many left. And so to the very end, to the very scaffold. This, I imagine, is how it was with Karamazov then. They've not had time yet, he must have thought. I may still find some way out. Oh, there's still time to make some plan of defense. And now, now, she is so fascinating. His soul was full of confusion and dread, but he managed, however, to put aside half his money and hide it somewhere. I cannot otherwise explain the disappearance of quite half of the 3,000 he'd just taken from his father's pillow. He had been in Mokroe more than once before. He had caroused there for 2 days together already. He knew the old big house with all its passages and outbuildings. I imagine that part of the money was hidden in that house, not long before the arrest, in some crevice, under some floor, in some corner, under the roof. With what object? I shall be asked. Why, the catastrophe may take place at once, of course. He hadn't yet considered how to meet it. He hadn't the time. His head was throbbing, and his heart was with her. But money, money was indispensable in any case. With money, a man is always a man. Perhaps such foresight at such a moment may strike you as unnatural. But he assures us himself that a month before, at a critical and exciting moment, he had halved his money and sewn it up in a little bag. And though that was not true, as we shall prove directly, it shows the idea was a familiar one to Karamazov. He had contemplated it. What's more, when he declared at the inquiry that he'd put 1,500 rubles in a bag, which never existed, he may have invented that little bag on the inspiration of the moment, because he had, 2 hours before, divided his money and hidden half of it at Mokroe till morning, in case of emergency, simply not to have it on himself. Two extremes, gentlemen of the jury. Remember that Karamazov can contemplate two extremes, and both at once. We have looked in the house, but we haven't found the money. It may still be there, or it may have disappeared next day and be in the prisoner's hands now. In any case, he was at her side, on his knees before her. She was lying on the bed, he had his hands stretched out to her, and he had so entirely forgotten everything that he did not even hear the men coming to arrest him. He hadn't time to prepare any line of defense in his mind. He was caught unawares and confronted with his judges, the arbiters of his destiny. Gentlemen of the jury, there are moments in the execution of our duties when it is terrible for us to face a man, terrible on his account, too. The moments of contemplating that animal fear, when the criminal sees that all is lost, but still struggles, still means to struggle. The moments when every instinct of self-preservation rises up in him at once, and he looks at you with questioning and suffering eyes, studies you, your face, your thoughts, uncertain on which side you will strike. And his distracted mind frames thousands of plans in an instant, but he is still afraid to speak, afraid of giving himself away. This purgatory of the spirit, this animal thirst for self-preservation, these humiliating moments of the human soul are awful, and sometimes arouse horror and compassion for the criminal, even in the lawyer. And this was what we all witnessed then. At first he was thunderstruck, and in his terror dropped some very compromising phrases. Blood! I've deserved it. But he quickly restrained himself. He had not prepared what he was to say, what answer he was to make. He had nothing but a bare denial ready. I'm not guilty of my father's death. That was his fence for the moment, and behind it he hoped to throw up a barricade of some sort.
His first compromising exclamations he hastened to explain by declaring that he was responsible for the death of the servant Grigory only. Of that bloodshed I am guilty. But who has killed my father, gentlemen? Who has killed him? Who can have killed him, if not I? Do you hear? He asked us that. Us who had come to ask him that question. Do you hear that phrase uttered with such premature haste? If not I? The animal cunning, the naivete, the Karamazov impatience of it. I didn't kill him, and you mustn't think I did. I wanted to kill him, gentlemen, I wanted to kill him, he hastens to admit. He was in a hurry, a terrible hurry. But still I'm not guilty. It is not I murdered him. He concedes to us that he wanted to murder him, as though to say, you can see for yourselves how truthful I am, so you'll believe all the sooner that I didn't murder him. Oh, in such cases the criminal is often amazingly shallow and credulous. At that point one of the lawyers asked him, as it were, incidentally, the most simple question. Wasn't it Smerdyakov killed him? Then, as we expected, he was horribly angry at our having anticipated him and caught him unawares before he had time to pave the way to choose and snatch the moment when it would be most natural to bring in Smerdyakov's name. He rushed at once to the other extreme, as he always does, and began to assure us that Smerdyakov could not have killed him, was not capable of it. But don't believe him, that was only his cunning. He didn't really give up the idea of Smerdyakov. On the contrary, he meant to bring him forward again, for indeed he had no one else to bring forward. But he would do that later, because for the moment that line was spoiled for him. He would bring him forward, perhaps next day or even a few days later, choosing an opportunity to cry out to us, you know, I was more sceptical about Smerdyakov than you. You remember that yourselves, but now I'm convinced he killed him, he must have done. And for the present he falls back upon a gloomy and irritable denial. Impatience and anger prompted him, however, to the most inept and incredible explanation of how he looked into his father's window and how he respectfully withdrew. The worst of it was that he was unaware of the position of affairs, of the evidence given by Grigory. We proceeded to search him. The search angered but encouraged him. The whole 3,000 had not been found on him, only half of it, and no doubt only at the moment of angry silence that fiction of the little bag first occurred to him. No doubt he was conscious himself of the improbability of the story and strove painfully to make it sound more likely, to weave it into a romance that would sound plausible. In such cases, the first duty, the chief task, of the investigating lawyers is to prevent the criminal being prepared, to pounce upon him unexpectedly so that he may blurt out his cherished ideas in all their simplicity, improbability, and inconsistency. The criminal can only be made to speak by the sudden and apparently incidental communication of some new fact, of some circumstance of great importance in the case, of which he had no previous idea and could not have foreseen. We had such a fact in readiness. That was Grigory's evidence about the open door through which the prisoner had run out. He had completely forgotten about that door and had not even suspected that Grigory could have seen it. The effect of it was amazing. He leapt up and shouted to us. Then Smerdyakov murdered him. It was Smerdyakov. And so betrayed the basis of the defence he was keeping back, and betrayed it in its most improbable shape, for Smerdyakov could only have committed the murder after he had knocked Grigory down and run away. When we told him that Grigory saw the door was open before he fell down, and had heard Smerdyakov behind the screen as he came out of his bedroom, Karamazov was positively crushed. My esteemed and witty colleague, Nikolai Parfenovich, told me afterwards that he was almost moved to tears at the sight of him, and to improve matters the prisoner hastened to tell us about the much-talked-of little bag. So be it. You shall hear this romance. Gentlemen of the jury, I've told you already why I consider this romance not only an absurdity but the most improbable invention that could have been brought forward in the circumstances. If one tried for a bet to invent the most unlikely story, one could hardly find anything more incredible. The worst of such stories is that the triumphant romances can always be put to confusion and crushed by the very details in which real life is so rich, and which these unhappy and involuntary storytellers neglect as insignificant trifles. Oh, they have no thought to spare for such details. Their minds are concentrated on their grand invention as a whole, and fancy anyone daring to pull them up for a trifle.
But that's how they are caught. The prisoner was asked the question, "Where did you get the stuff for your little bag, and who made it for you?" "I made it myself." "And where did you get the linen?" The prisoner was positively offended. He thought it almost insulting to ask him such a trivial question. And would you believe it, his resentment was genuine. But they're all like that. "I tore it off my shirt." "Then we shall find that shirt among your linen tomorrow, with a piece torn off. And only fancy, gentlemen of the jury, if we really had found that torn shirt. And how could we have failed to find it in his chest of drawers or trunks? That would have been a fact, a material fact in support of his statement. But he was incapable of that reflection. I don't remember, it may not have been off my shirt. I sewed it up in one of my landlady's caps." "What sort of a cap?" "It was an old cotton rag of hers lying about." "And do you remember that clearly?" "No, I don't." And he was angry, very angry. And yet imagine not remembering it at the most terrible moments of man's life, for instance, when he's being led to execution. He remembers just such trifles. He will forget anything but some green roof that has flashed past him on the road, or a jackdaw on a cross. That he will remember. He concealed the making of that little bag from his household. He must have remembered his humiliating fear that someone might come in and find him needle in hand. How at the slightest sound he slipped behind the screen. There is a screen in his lodgings. But, gentlemen of the jury, why do I tell you all this, all these details, trifles?"
cried Ippolit Kirillovich suddenly.
"Just because the prisoner still persists in his absurdities to this moment. He has not explained anything since that fatal night 2 months ago. He has not added one actual illuminating fact to his former fantastic statements. All those are trivialities. You must believe it on my honour. Oh, we are glad to believe it. We are eager to believe it, even if only on his word of honour. Are we jackals thirsting for human blood? Show us a single fact in the prisoner's favour and we shall rejoice. But let it be a substantial, real fact, and not a conclusion drawn from the prisoner's expression by his own brother. Or that when he beat himself on the breast he must have meant to point to the little bag, in the darkness too. We shall rejoice at the new fact. We shall be the first to repudiate our charge. We shall hasten to repudiate it. But now justice cries out and we persist. We cannot repudiate anything."
Ippolit Kirillovich passed to his final peroration. He looked as though he was in a fever. He spoke of the blood that cried for vengeance, the blood of the father murdered by his son, with the base motive of robbery. He pointed to the tragic and glaring consistency of the facts.
"And whatever you may hear from the talented and celebrated counsel for the defence,"
Ippolit Kirillovich could not resist adding,
"whatever eloquent and touching appeals may be made to your sensibilities, remember that at this moment you are in a temple of justice. Remember that you are the champions of our justice, the champions of our holy Russia, of her principles, her family, everything that she holds sacred. Yes, you represent Russia here at this moment, and your verdict will be heard not in this hall only, but will re-echo throughout the whole of Russia. Then all Russia will hear you as her champions and her judges, and she will be encouraged or disheartened by your verdict. Do not disappoint Russia and her expectations. Our fatal troika dashes on in her headlong flight, perhaps to destruction. And in all Russia for long past, men have stretched out imploring hands and called a halt to its furious, reckless course. And if other nations stand aside from that troika, that may be not from respect, as the poet would fain believe, but simply from horror. From horror, perhaps from disgust. And well it is that they stand aside, but maybe they will cease one day to do so and will form a firm wall confronting the hurrying apparition, and will check the frenzied rush of our lawlessness for the sake of their own safety, enlightenment, and civilization. Already we have heard voices of alarm from Europe. They already begin to sound. Do not tempt them. Do not heap up their growing hatred by a sentence justifying the murder of a father by his son."
Though Ippolit Kirillovich was genuinely moved, he wound up his speech with this rhetorical appeal, and the effect produced by him was extraordinary. When he'd finished his speech, he went out hurriedly, and, as I've mentioned before, almost fainted in the adjoining room. There was no applause in the court, but serious persons were pleased. The ladies were not so well satisfied, though even they were pleased with his eloquence, especially as they had no apprehensions as to the upshot of the trial, and had full trust in Fetyukovitch. He will speak at last, and of course carry all before him. Everyone looked at Mitya. He sat silent through the whole of the prosecutor's speech, clenching his teeth, with his hands clasped and his head bowed. Only from time to time he raised his head and listened, especially when Grushenko was spoken of. When the prosecutor mentioned Rakitin's opinion of her, a smile of contempt and anger passed over his face, and he murmured rather audibly, "The Bernards!" When Ippolit Kirillovich described how he had questioned and tortured him at Mokroe, Mitya raised his head and listened with intense curiosity. At one point he seemed about to jump up and cry out, but controlled himself and only shrugged his shoulders disdainfully. People talked afterwards of the end of the speech, of the prosecutor's feat in examining the prisoner at Mokroe, and jeered at Ippolit Kirillovich. "The man could not resist boasting of his cleverness," they said. The court was adjourned, but only for a short interval, a quarter of an hour or 20 minutes at most. There was a hum of conversation and exclamations in the audience. I remember some of them. "A weighty speech," a gentleman in one group observed gravely. "He brought in too much psychology," said another voice. "But it was all true, the absolute truth." "Yes, he has first-rated it. He summed it all up."
"Yes, he summed us up, too,"
chimed in another voice.
"Do you remember at the beginning of his speech making out we were all like Fyodor Pavlovich?"
"And at the end, too, but that was all rot."
"And obscure, too."
"He was just a little too much carried away."
"It's unjust. It's unjust."
"No, it's smartly done, anyway. He's had long to wait, but he's had his say. Ha-ha!
What will the counsel for the defence say?"
In another group I heard,
"He had no business to make a thrust at the Petersburg man like that, appealing to your sensibilities, do you remember?"
"Yes, that was awkward of him."
"He was in too great a hurry."
"He's a nervous man."
"We laugh, but what must the prisoner be feeling?"
"Yes, what must it be for Mitya?"
In a third group, "What lady is that, the fat one with the lorgnette sitting at the end?"
"Oh, she's a general's wife, divorced, I know her."
"That's why she has the lorgnette."
"She's not good for much."
"Oh, no, she's a piquant little woman."
"Two places beyond her there's a little fair woman. She's prettier."
"They caught him smartly at Mokroe, didn't they?"
"No, smart enough. We've heard before how often he has told the story at people's houses."
"And he couldn't resist doing it now. That's vanity."
"He's a man with a grievance."
"Yes, and quick to take offence. And there was too much rhetoric, such long sentences."
"Yes, he tries to alarm us. He kept trying to alarm us. Do you remember about the Troika? Something about they have Hamlets, but we have, so far, only Karamazovs?"
"That was cleverly said."
"That was to propitiate the liberals. He's afraid of them."
"Yes, and he's afraid of the lawyer, too."
"Yes, what will Fetyukovitch say?"
"Whatever he says, he won't get round our peasants."
"Do you think so?" A fourth group.
"What he said about the Troika was good, that piece about the other nations."
"And that was true what he said about other nations not standing it."
"What do you mean?"
"Why, in the English Parliament, a member got up last week and, speaking about the Nihilists, asked the Ministry whether it was not high time to intervene, to educate this barbarous people. Ippolit was thinking of him, I know he was. He was talking about that last week."
"Not an easy job."
"Not an easy job, why not?"
"Why, we'd shut up Kronstadt and not let them have any corn. Where would they get it?"
"In America, they get it from America now."
"Nonsense."
But the bell rang. All rushed to their places. Fetyukovich mounted the tribune. Chapter 10. The speech for the defence. An argument that cuts both ways. All was hushed as the first words of the famous orator rang out. The eyes of the audience were fastened upon him. He began very simply and directly, with an air of conviction, but not the slightest trace of conceit. He made no attempt at eloquence, at pathos, or emotional phrases. He was like a man speaking in a circle of intimate and sympathetic friends. His voice was a fine one, sonorous and sympathetic, and there was something genuine and simple in the very sound of it. But everyone realized at once that the speaker might suddenly rise to genuine pathos and pierce the heart with untold power. His language was perhaps more irregular than Ippolit Kirillovich's, but he spoke without long phrases, and indeed with more precision. One thing did not please the ladies. He kept bending forward, especially at the beginning of his speech, not exactly bowing, but as though he were about to dart at his listeners, bending his long spine in half, as though there were a spring in the middle that enabled him to bend at right angles. At the beginning of his speech he spoke rather disconnectedly, without system, one may say, dealing with facts separately, though at the end these facts formed a whole. His speech might be divided into two parts, the first consisting of criticism in refutation of the charge, sometimes malicious and sarcastic. But in the second half he suddenly changed his tone and even his manner, and at once rose to pathos. The audience seemed on the lookout for it and quivered with enthusiasm. He went straight to the point and began by saying that although he practiced in Petersburg, he had more than once visited provincial towns to defend prisoners, of whose innocence he had a conviction, or at least a preconceived idea. "That is what has happened to me in the present case," he explained. "From the very first accounts in the newspapers, I was struck by something which strongly prepossessed me in the prisoner's favour. What interested me most was a fact which often occurs in legal practice, but rarely, I think, in such an extreme and peculiar form as in the present case. I ought to formulate that peculiarity only at the end of my speech, but I will do so at the very beginning, for it is my weakness to go to work directly, not keeping my effects in reserve and economizing my material. That may be imprudent on my part, but at least it's sincere. What I have in my mind is this. There's an overwhelming chain of evidence against the prisoner, and at the same time not one fact that will stand criticism, if it is examined separately. As I followed the case more closely in the papers, my idea was more and more confirmed, and I suddenly received from the prisoner's relatives a request to undertake his defense. I at once hurried here, and here I became completely convinced. It was to break down this terrible chain of facts, and to show that each piece of evidence taken separately was unproved and fantastic, that I undertook the case." So Fetyukovich began. "Gentlemen of the jury," he suddenly protested, "I am new to this district. I have no preconceived ideas. The prisoner, a man of turbulent and unbridled temper, has not insulted me, but he has insulted perhaps hundreds of persons in this town, and so prejudiced many people against him beforehand. Of course, I recognize that the moral sentiment of local society is justly excited against him. The prisoner is of turbulent and violent temper. Yet he was received in society here. He was even welcome in the family of my talented friend, the prosecutor." N.B. At these words there were two or three laughs in the audience, quickly suppressed, but noticed by all. All of us knew that the prosecutor received Mitya against his will, solely because he had somehow interested his wife, a lady of the highest virtue and moral worth, but fanciful, capricious, and fond of opposing her husband, especially in trifles. Mitya's visits, however, had not been frequent. "Nevertheless, I venture to suggest," Petyukovich continued, "that in spite of his independent mind and just character, my opponent may have formed a mistaken prejudice against my unfortunate client. Oh, that is so natural. The unfortunate man has only too well deserved such prejudice. Outraged morality, and still more outraged taste, is often relentless. We have, in the talented prosecutor's speech, heard a stern analysis of the prisoner's character and conduct, and his severe critical attitude to the case was evident. And what's more, he went into psychological subtleties into which he could not have entered if he had the least conscious and malicious prejudice against the prisoner. But there are things which are even worse, even more fatal in such cases, than the most malicious and consciously unfair attitude. It is worse if we are carried away by the artistic instincts,
by the desire to create, so to speak, a romance, especially if God has endowed us with psychological insight. Before I started on my way here, I was warned in Petersburg, and was myself aware that I should find a talented opponent whose psychological insight and subtlety had gained him peculiar renown in legal circles of recent years. But profound as psychology is, it's a knife that cuts both ways. Laughter among the